Thank you. Right, got my clicker, got the water, got the most difficult passage to preach on ever. Yeah, you're right. When I first, when Sam asked me to preach this week, I said, I'm free on the 16th of June. That's actually a great week for me to do it. And I hadn't actually read the passage. Then I read it and I thought, ooh, this is a meaty one. This is going to be fun. And when I told my husband, Jake, that I was preaching this Sunday on the topic of wifely submission to her husband, he found this hilarious. He spent a good 5 minutes just laughing. Because Jake and I have been married for just over 2 years now, and if he had to choose one word or even 10 words to describe me, not one of them would be submissive. But, of course, our passage from 1 Peter today is about much, much more than just what might, on the face of it, sound like slightly old-fashioned advice about wives to submit to their husbands. So to settle on just the conclusion that that's what it's all about would be to miss out on some rather profound truths that I think are relevant for all humanity, and they're found in this passage. So I thought we could look a little bit closer at what Peter actually says in his letter. There's a huge amount of content. So firstly, to set the scene a little bit, Peter is writing to Christian communities that are scattered throughout the country that we now know today as Turkey. Individuals from these communities would be facing regular persecution. They would be considered at the very least rather odd in their societies, and at worst they would be considered a danger to the status quo, and they would be persecuted, imprisoned, possibly even killed. So that's why at the very start of his letter, right back in chapter 1, Peter actually addresses the reader of this letter as a foreigner. Not because that person who's reading it is living physically in a foreign land, but because they're set apart from the culture of those around them because of their belief in Jesus Christ. This is a key theme for Peter, and this is how we're to be set apart and to be holy. So, actually, Derek, if I could have the slides, thank you. So this is why Peter begins this way. He implores the reader to look at Jesus' example. Jesus faced hurled insults and suffering, just like the Christians Peter was writing to would have done. Jesus was blameless, as we are all not, yet amazingly he did not retaliate or threaten those who publicly scorned, tortured, and even eventually murdered him. In fact, we know from the gospel accounts that he even went as far as to be able to pray for them on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." But Peter isn't just telling these people about Jesus because Jesus is, you know, a good guy to copy or anything like that. Peter is really wanting the reader to remember the central truth of the good news at this point. Peter wants them to remember everything that Jesus has done for them. Peter says he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that by his wounds you have been healed. Because of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross and triumph over death at Easter, everything has changed. The whole world and our place in it as a people set apart by trusting in Jesus has been transformed. So Peter says, before you were like sheep going astray, but now you have turned to the shepherd and the overseer of your souls. So before we were one of the herd and we followed the lost sheep, but now we stand out from the herd and we follow the voice of the shepherd. So we stand out from the crowd. Why is it important to remember this in particular? Why does Peter want to start here and really kind of give, I guess, the whole gospel message all in one hit to his readers before giving advice to husbands and wives? Well, because it's essential context for the teaching about husbands and wives. Without the context of the gospel behind it, telling wives to submit to their husbands and husbands to be kind to their weak wives, it just sounds like old-fashioned, gender-stereotypical advice of a patriarchal society that really wouldn't be all that relevant to us today, I would like to say. However, it's not that at all. With Jesus at the centre of the picture, Peter's teaching takes on a whole new spiritual dimension. It's a calling to follow Jesus' radical demands that are about countercultural behaviour, and these require actually great courage and strength and faith. So Peter puts this into the context of a husband and wife at the start of chapter 3. So why was Peter concerned about telling wives and husbands how to treat each other? Why did it matter? Well, when I was researching the passage, I actually learned something I didn't know before. So I found it really interesting. This is that in the time of Peter, it starts a little sad. So in the time of Peter, it was actually really common for female babies to be abandoned at birth. They were considered a burden on their families, and so very often female babies were not cared for and raised in the family. They were often left, they said, exposed, and they were left to die. So this wasn't a practice that Christians took part in. Christians shunned this, and they were quite unusual in doing so. And so the result was that amongst the female population at the time of Peter's writing, there was actually more Christian women around than non-Christian women. And a lot of these Christian women married non-Christian men. And so there's a theologian, Tom Wright, who you may have heard of before, a really famous theologian. He says that the historical evidence shows that one of the primary ways the Christian faith was even spread during that time was through marriage. Non-Christian men married Christian women. There were just a lot of them around. And so these men were won to faith by the example of their wives, despite the best efforts of the authorities at the time to stamp out Christianity. Although they were persecuted, although the state didn't want Christians around, just marriages were happening, and people were being won over by the examples of their wives. This could be described as an early version of the flirt to convert strategy, if you've ever come across such a thing. Not that I'm condoning anything like that. But I am married to someone who wouldn't consider them a Christian, so he always teases me that I was flirting to convert. This now makes sense as to why Peter chooses to address Christian wives directly, why he thought it was important to say this, and to give clear instruction on how to stand out from the crowd. People would be looking to them as an example. So what advice do you give? Firstly, he says women should submit to their husbands. And then the second part of his advice really is about choosing to cultivate inner beauty over external beauty. So this is a little bit of a summary of all of his advice, but the two bottom bits are what we'll focus on. So firstly, submission. How would you feel if someone described you as submissive? Put your hands up if you think you'd feel it was a compliment. Put your hands up if you think you'd be slightly offended. Yeah, that's what I thought as well. What are the first sort of images that come to your mind when you say the word submissive? It's often, oh, it's a bit of a walkover, or a bit weak, just, you know, nothing, no backbone. I think the way we use the word in our culture today is seen much more negatively than positively, and unfortunately it is a word that's often associated with abuse of power and some of those really negative relationships. However, this could be a language feature that's particular to English, our culture, and the way we use it now. And it might not have been so much the case in Jesus' time, and Peter's time as well. It's a word that's used throughout the New Testament, and there are times when it's used and Jesus submits to the authorities or to his parents at one point, and various other times. So it's interesting to actually look at the word itself. Some theologians say that the translation today, submission, isn't probably the best translation of the Greek word, hupotasso, that Peter uses. And they gave a range of alternative words, but one alternative translation that I really liked was to get underneath and lift up. So the wives are being possibly suggested that you should kind of get behind and help lift your husband, who you have committed your life to. I think that I could get on board with a lot better. But perhaps if we do look at slightly different words that paint a similar picture, maybe things like selflessness and gentleness, kindness, humility, and patience, those all paint a picture of the sort of qualities Peter is advising wives to cultivate, and I think that they're things we could all agree on are great things to really admire in each other and to try and cultivate. I also find it helpful when I was trying to get my head around submission and what it really means. I thought, well, what's the opposite of submission? If we don't think it's a good thing to be described as submissive, what's the opposite? And is that a better thing? What's the opposite of submission? It's dominion, or to dominate. To exert one's own power and control and will over somebody else, and to kind of seek to have your own way all the time. Is that such a good thing either? I would say probably not. It's certainly something I can't imagine Jesus teaching us to do. He didn't stand there on the Sermon of the Mount and said, blessed are the people who are in charge. Blessed are the powerful and the rulers and the people who get their own way all the time. In fact, Jesus said, blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. And a passage that's often preached at weddings, 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not boast. It is not proud. does not dishonour others, it is not self-seeking, easily angered, or keep records of wrongs. And that sounds like a really good description of what Peter's trying to get at here to me. Encouraging wives to behave their husbands this way, and I think it's something we could all get behind. Now, is it easy to do, to be meek? Does anyone find it easy to be meek in their day-to-day lives? Or, like me, do you get quite easily riled and quick with a bit of a sharp word? No, in fact, it takes a huge amount of strength to submit your ego and your will to somebody else's kind of wills and desires, even someone you love as much as your husband. So considering that women in Peter's time would have been considered weak and not very strong, it's quite a paradox here that Peter's asking them to do something really strong. He's asking them to step up to the plate and lead the way as this example and do something that we all find really, really tough. So the second thing that Peter emphasises for wives is to cultivate this inner beauty. Following the example of the holy women of the past, like Sarah in the Old Testament, while other women of the time and of our time now may focus on external adornments, you know, fine jewellery, braided hair. I left my tiara at home, you know, so I couldn't wear it today. But shunning these distractions is yet another way that women following Jesus can stand out from the crowd. Having no need of worldly approval for beauty, she's to focus on the way that God sees her, with her inner beauty, which is unfading and of great worth in God's sight. Many of you will remember Gerard Kelly, who came to our church weekend away last year, and he's a writer. I have a book of his spoken worship poems. They're absolutely brilliant, but he's got a poem called Humanifesto. And he writes, "No camouflage, no entourage, no smoothly fitting in. I want a faith that goes further than face value and a beauty that goes deeper than my skin." I just think that's really beautiful, and it's something that's always stuck with me. I read that when I was a teenager, and you know, going through all that teenage angst of, oh, how do I look, and oh, does anybody like me? And I've actually found that really encouraging all throughout my life. It also made me think of our church verse for the year, Isaiah 61:3. "They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendour." Again, it's very much about the display of these wives as righteous women of God will be of God's splendour, not of the world's splendour. We all know in our heart of hearts, don't we, that obsession with beauty and being admired by the world for how we look or what we wear, chasing after kind of those external appearances won't give us any lasting satisfaction. We've all been there and gone on a shopping spree maybe, thinking that it will make us feel really, really great. And while we've got that head knowledge, we know that it's ultimately all going to fade away. But do we really live it out? Is our focus and attention in the right balance between the way we present ourselves and concern with how we present ourselves and how we cultivate our inner beauty? How much mental time and energy do we spend on worrying about what we look like in the morning versus how are you going to behave in the morning and how are you going to treat the people around you? And when we first meet someone new, do we fall into the trap of putting them into a box in our minds based on what they wear, maybe what house they have or what car they have? Although we know in our heads that these things don't mean anything, we so easily fall into the trap all the time that society wants us to, that these are things that really, really matter. But Peter's saying to the wives he's addressing here, this is not what is important. We need to stand out from the crowd and cultivate inner beauty instead. So husbands, it's your turn. It's not just wives who Peter calls to be countercultural. Verse 7, Peter gives the following instructions to husbands. "Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers." Again, Jake laughed out loud when he heard wives described as the weaker partner. He enjoyed jiving me for that one for a few days. He's always like, oh, it's just because you're so weak, Rachel, just so weak. But in all seriousness, what does Peter actually mean here? Well, at first it might look like he's just comparing physical strength. You know, Jake can beat me at an arm wrestle. Not disputing that at all. Or perhaps it reflects the common view of the time that women are lesser because they're frail or weak, not even just necessarily physically. They're just of a different social standing. They're not educated and all these other things. But I read around this a little more, and some very clever people who've done lots of research into the history of this and the Bible come to a conclusion that they say that in Peter's world, where women were very much seen as a secondary citizen, Aristotle even said they were a secondary form of human being, they were routinely denied the freedoms and rights and privileges that men had. And so they say that this is what Peter really means by being weaker. They're weaker in society's eyes. They don't have the same advantages that a man would have. And so by that respect, they're much more vulnerable. And that's why he describes them as the weaker partner. They're the vulnerable partner. They're the ones that society has not afforded advantages to. So what Peter's saying here is that he demands that men acknowledge this in the relationship with their wives, that they're considerate of the fact that they, being men, through no doing of their own, have advantages that their wives do not have. And rather than letting this go to their heads and exploiting it, they must remember to treat their wives with respect, as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. And what does it mean to be an heir of the gift of life? Well, since the gift of life is given in abundance by God's grace, and nobody can earn any more or any less of it, and no one receives any more or any less of it than anybody else, it's given completely abundantly, more than we can possibly ever imagine, then everybody is equal in its receipt. So men and women in this passage are therefore being considered as equals. Now, this would have been an extraordinary message of the time. Again, we have to just understand how lowly women were thought of in Peter's time to get our heads around the fact that Peter is being very radical here. It's a radical message of equality rather than just a defence of the patriarchy and the status quo. So if I was to try to summarise Peter's overall advice in this passage in just a few sentences, this would be my best shot at a two-sentence summary. So for wives, I would say that Peter's advice could be summarised as, be selfless and reject the worldly clamour for recognition and you will lift others up with you. That's quite nice, isn't it? And Peter's advice for husbands could be, acknowledge in what ways you are on top in society's eyes. Don't let it go to your head. Remember that those without these advantages are your equals and treat them well and with respect. This is great advice for anyone, for all humankind. So playing with that, and let's do a bit of thinking, let's imagine now that Peter's instructions are being directed to all people, to men and women, married and unmarried, young and old. This passage can provide guidance in many relational situations where perhaps there is a power dynamic at play because of the way society views our respective roles and value. So perhaps ask yourself, where are you in a situation of greater power or privilege over another person or a group of people, just like the husbands Peter addresses were? This could be, for instance, an employer or an employee, parents and children, very apt for Father's Day, maybe consumer and supplier, the rich and the poor. What are our obligations to others within these power dynamics, according to Peter? And on the other hand, what situations are you the weaker partner? Where are you maybe more vulnerable in society's eyes or have less power and control compared to somebody else? And how does it make you feel when that's the situation? And how do you react to that? What does Jesus' example demand of us in that situation? And how do we cultivate the inner beauty that God values, treat others with respect and equality, and respond to those who have power over us with gentleness? I'm not going to tell you the answer to any of those questions. There's some questions for you to go away and think about, but to wrap up, I will say that just personally, I've been challenged to think carefully about the dynamics of all my relationships as a result of this passage. So I lead a team at work, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, and I'm an elder sister. I report to my superiors in the university where I work. I buy things every day from large corporations. And in day-to-day life, in a million different ways, I'm entering into a partnership in some way with other people. And often this is a partnership with people I see, but even more often it's a partnership with people I do not see. For instance, I buy a piece of clothing online. How many people have been involved in the purchase, and where are my obligation, and what are my obligations to all of those people? As the consumer and as part of the wealthiest 1% of the world, as I think we all are just by virtue of being in this country, I know that it is likely that if I buy something cheap and disposable that was manufactured, say, in a developing country far away, it's likely that someone somewhere who has less advantages than me paid the real price for that piece of clothing that's disposable to me. And it was paid with their low-paid labour, maybe paid for with their health, perhaps working in a hazardous environment. And so my day-to-day decisions in the power dynamic between us, I have the greater privilege, but am I treating those people down the line as an heir with me, as the gracious gift of life that Jesus gives, as equals? Do I respect that society grants them less advantage than me? Am I therefore considerate of that fact as I go about my business and seek to treat them well? And do I seek to find ways to invite them more into a partnership of equals with me? So I hope that was sort of interesting for you to hear maybe a different take on that passage, and hopefully two of those ideas were useful to you. But we're going to move into a time of discussion for a few minutes, and then a bit of prayer to draw on some of the themes we just explored. And I've sort of broken our discussion time and prayer time into two key themes. So firstly, peace and reconciliation for a hurting world. What situations of division and fear in the world do you feel most kind of are on your heart at the moment and you would like to pray for? But thinking particularly about that gentleness and the power that potentially listening and bridge building and looking to lift people up rather than have your say and dominate could bring into that situation. I was thinking particularly, I mean, we've got, you look at the news and it's Donald Trump, Putin, Boris Johnson. You've got people who are basically putting out this strongman image, the kind of the want to dominate. And wouldn't it be interesting if we had some leaders that were a bit more pull than push, and that was a lot more about humility and meekness, righteousness, and some of those qualities coming through in the leadership of our world. So maybe we could think about that. And then equality. We've talked a lot about inequality in this passage and looking at the way that women were second-class citizens and around the world in many places they still are. So what inequalities do you see in the world today that make you angry? And what can we do daily to check our privilege, so to use that phrase, and treat all people as our equals, and to remember that teaching from Peter?